Some subjects are just easier to talk about than others. Cannibalism seems to exist in that category, the less easy to talk about. The idea of people eating each other seems to produce more jokes than straight conversations. But cannibalism is not just about people. It's all about creatures that eat their fellow creatures. And the science is fascinating. Fascinating enough for Bill Shutt to write a book about it. It's called Cannibalism, A Perfectly Natural History. Bill Shutt is a biology professor at LIU Post, Long Island University's branch in Greenville, New York. He's written two other books, one a novel, the other called Dark Banquet, Blood and the Curious Lives of Blood-Feeding Creatures. Bill Shutt, I'm sensing a theme in your nonfiction work here.
Yeah, my relatives and friends have been pointing that out for years.
No doubt. I want to point out there is a big sense of humor in here. I mean, chapter titles like Go On, Eat the Kids. So you have fun with this, clearly.
Yeah, I just, as an educator, I think I like my audience to be entertained, and where appropriate, I'd like to be able to add some humor. Of course, there are places where that's not appropriate, and I try to be as sensitive as I can.
Yeah, and you do that well. And I should point out that there's a, you know, it's not surprising you'd have the fictional Hannibal Lecter character in here, but you also give us Ed Gein, who is a real life story. And I did not know until I lived in Wisconsin briefly that there was a real backstory for what became Psycho.
Yeah, Robert Bloch, when he wrote his novella, just decided to he used Ed Gein as you know, the inspiration for the Norman Bates character, but got rid of the cannibalism aspect and just sort of emphasized the mother, the problems that he had with his mother.
So, you know, marveling at individual cannibals like Ed Gein gives way to labeling whole groups of people. I mean, there have been situations in history where anthropologists just swore that these tribes were just all cannibals. Has that been the truth?
Yeah, problematic, I think. And I think less so nowadays. You know, we have a knee-jerk reaction to this idea of cannibalism, and I think in the West that we've been fed this idea about cannibalism as the worst taboo that you can undertake for 2,000 years or so, maybe more, since the time of the ancient Romans and Greeks, and through Shakespeare and the Brothers Grimm and Daniel Defoe with Robinson Crusoe, so that when you think about cannibalism, you think about this horror show of criminals, or you think about people who are starving, and I think that you know, that type of label was used to sort of bludgeon indigenous people when explorers you know, came to say the New World, and they would report back that these people were nice and everybody was kind of cool and everybody was getting along and they didn't find any gold and decided that they needed another resource to bring home. And so humans became that resource, and the justification that they used to dehumanize these people were instances where they may or may not have performed ritual cannibalism.
So it's easy to apply the label of savage when you can demonstrate or at least claim savage behavior.
Yeah, absolutely, and I think it was used by many European countries as they moved out into through the age, what, you know, the age of discovery, I guess people call it.
Right. So let's move on beyond the anthropological, though, to you question in the book whether the aversion to cannibalism is hardwired into the human brain. What'd you find out?
Yeah, I don't think that there's a gene that dictates that we are or are not cannibals. I believe that cannibalism is natural behavior in humans in extreme circumstances. So I'm certainly not promoting cannibalism. But if you put a group of people into a situation where there's nothing else to eat and there are no other options except starve to death or die, then you are going to either consume bodies or you're going to starve to death. And then, you know, then there are also customs throughout the world, at least there used to be, and these are people who never got the story of Western taboos, so they developed their own rituals. So I mean, so in a sense, culture is king. If you don't grow up hearing that cannibalism is the worst taboo in the world, then you develop your own rituals about things like medicine or burial practices. When the Westerners, for example, went into Brazil and met a tribe called the Waray. The Waray were just as mortified to learn that the Westerners buried their dead as the Westerners were, that the Waray were consuming their loved ones after they died. You know, they couldn't believe that we would put our loved ones in the ground to rot and be eaten by worms. You know, why not incorporate them into yourself, they'd tell these people.
Oh, so they had just as much revulsion to the Western practices as the Westerners had to theirs.
Absolutely. And if you think about it, if you don't grow up hearing that, you know, if you're bad, then cannibals are going to eat you, if you're reading Hansel and Gretel, hearing about Polyphemus and Odysseus and the Cyclops eating Odysseus's men and you know, Shakespeare and on and on, and Sigmund Freud. If you don't grow up getting that angle, then then you're free to develop your own ideas about consuming humans.
That is an interesting angle, though, the fact that we alternately seem to go ew and ha ha about cannibalism. There are a lot of jokes about cannibalism, like the two guys eating the clown. Does this taste funny to you? Stuff like that.
Yeah, I guess I've heard them all.
No doubt. Did you invite your students to bring some to class?
No, I try to keep that separate from my work at school.
Even the footnotes in the book are actually pretty funny. I mean, why should you read the book while listening to the song Timothy?
Timothy was actually a song that came out in 1971 by the same guy who wrote the Pina Colada song.
Oh, sure, yeah, Rupert Holmes.
I mean, and it's really the definition of a one-hit wonder. It's really catchy, and it's the story of these three miners who are trapped, and they wind up eating Timothy. So the song, when it came out, was a fairly decent hit, but there were a bunch of radio stations that wouldn't play it. So Scepter Records contacted them and said, oh, listen, Timothy's really a mule. That's not really a person. No one believed them, but it's still a catchy tune. If you can dig it up today, it's kind of fun.
More with Bill Shutt and Cannibalism on the Jefferson Exchange in 1 minute. So let's look at the tracks leading up to what you've done here, Bill. Has science studied cannibalism across the animal kingdom much before now?
Well, they have, but the thing is that nobody really synthesized it. So you had a lot of people starting in the late 1970s and through the 1980s working on their own groups of creatures, but nobody really put together the entire spectrum of the animal kingdom. And when they finally did, it was a very academic book. It wasn't really written for our general readers. So that's what that to me was really interesting, to be able to go in and, in a sense, get rid of the jargon and still tell the interesting stories there.
Which are many in here. I mean, are there consistent theories about the kinds of species that will eat each other or the kinds of circumstances?
Great question. I think that although you find cannibalism across the entire animal kingdom, it's certainly more concentrated in groups like the invertebrates, animals like insects and arachnids, spiders and scorpions, and mollusks, things like snails. That's among the inverts. These are creatures that lay a lot of eggs. They have a lot of young. And so if some of them get eaten, then it's not really, you're not really, there's not a lot of individual recognition when you lay all of these eggs. And when some of the eggs get eaten, it's just kind of foraging behavior. Or you're taking some of those eggs and using them as kids' meals to provide nutrition for your young that do hatch. Among the vertebrates, more cannibalism. I think cannibalism happens, more often than not in egg-laying fish. If you've got a codfish that lays a million eggs, then she's not thinking of those eggs as individuals. She's thinking of them like we might think of a handful of raisins, completely harmless, very nutritious, and readily available. And then when you start to move through the vertebrates, you find it also occurs quite often in amphibians like frogs and toads. When you get into reptiles and birds, it's quite common. And then when you get into mammals, not so much, and primates even more rare. But it does happen, and it often happens for reasons that have nothing to do with a lack of food. That to me was the interesting thing.
So
this whole concept of parental care was one that I'd never known that before.
Expand on the parental care part.
Sure. Let's say my favorite example are these legless amphibians. So they're related to frogs, toads, and salamanders. They're called Sicilians, and that's with a C. I've got to sort of mention that because of my Italian relatives.
Right. Not from Sicily. Yes.
Yeah. So There are two major groups of them. One group lays eggs, the other gives birth to live young. And scientists years back realized that when the babies hatch, they swarm around their mother for days. And they took a look at this years later, and they realized that they weren't just squirming all over her. They were grabbing onto her skin and peeling it and consuming it, like just like you would peel and eat the skin of a grape. So they took a look at the skin, and they said, yikes, this is not accidental. This is the skin of these creatures, it was not dead. It's not like this dead epidermal layer. It's this fat-laden, nutrient-rich layer of skin that is consumed for several weeks by these hatchlings. And so then they looked at the live bearers, and the newborn Sicilians had this weird set of little teeth. And they went, well, why are they born with a set of teeth? And wonder what they use it for. And before they could figure that out, the teeth fell out. So they said, wait a second. So they backed up and they looked. They did some dissections on females that were pregnant. And they saw that in the oviducts, in the regions where these fetuses were developing, that the lining of the oviduct had been eaten away. And once again, they took a look at that layer, and this was not some type of strange behavior, or these were not, you know, this wasn't abnormal. This was a completely evolved system of parental care, because that lining was rich in nutrients that were being provided for these developing young, and it grew back just the way the skin grew back on the egg layers.
So that to me was
the most fascinating example, and there were just, you know, hundreds of other neat examples that I just never knew anything about.
Bill Schutz, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's a zoologist at LIU Post on Long Island and the author of Cannibalism, A Perfectly Natural History. You know, and I suppose some of us are sitting here going, ew, but then you remember that humans feed off their mothers, just not, you know, with their teeth.
Sure, yeah. I mean, it's in my mind, it's very similar to, say, a mom producing milk and feeding her newborn.
Do family ties get in the way or increase the appetite? I mean, obviously, in the parental care situations, they're going to be feeding off their own mothers. But when
sure.
animals are actually eating other animals of their own kind,
yeah.
are they indiscriminate, or are they not either?
No, great question. There is a tendency not to eat your own kin, and really there's an explanation for that. In the animal kingdom, that there's an evolutionary metric called inclusive fitness, which is in a sense a measurement of how many genes of yours there are in a population. So if you're eating your kin, you are reducing your inclusive fitness. So that is an evolutionary no-no. So I do find in many instances that there is some individual recognition once the young get to a certain age, and their mothers or the cannibals will avoid eating their own young. So that is a drawback.
So your favorite example from the sea are sand tiger sharks. Tell us what happens with them.
Yeah, they're a local species, and like a number of other sharks, the eggs hatch internally. And once again, like many other species, like birds, for example, lay eggs asynchronously. There are different eggs laid at different times. So you've got a bunch of different, you've got some differential development inside these mothers. And the first of the sharks to hatch internally will start to consume, once its own yolk is gone, will start to consume eggs. And it will keep eating and keep eating. And then and then the eggs start to hatch, and then consume the fetuses that hatch. So that by time, the mother gives birth, she gives birth to two sharks, one from each oviduct, and these are creatures that are, in a sense, already pre-adapted or having practiced, being predators.
So they've outcompeted their brothers, basically.
They absolutely have. You know, and that is, once again, an example of parental care that this evolved in these creatures.
Wow. And you really do explode some myths in here, and this one comes back to me because I lived in Levittown until I was 13, and so on Long Island, where you live now, we were always told there was a fine for killing a praying mantis. And
oh, yeah.
I ran
into that as well when I was a kid.
Doesn't happen, though, does it?
No. I've asked about that, and some people that I know heard the same thing, but I've not been able to figure out where that came from. I just think it's, you know, there's this pious angle to these creatures. They kind of look like they're praying. And rather than having little kids stomping them, I think adults would just rather us leave them alone and let them eat the pests that they normally feed on.
So the praying mantises are among the creatures where there's some cannibalism practice. It tends to work in one direction, though. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it has to do with size, I think, more than males getting eaten. There's a myth out there that it's always the females who are consuming the males, and that's just not the case. It's the who's ever biggest is consuming the smaller. And so, there are instances where, probably the most famous animals that we know as cannibals are black widow spiders and praying mantises. And unfortunately, some of that initial work was done that they starved these creatures, the moms, and then they put them, this was in captivity. So they were artificial situations. Nonetheless, there is cannibalism that does take place in there. And if you think of it this way, and you can sort of think of it the same way for black widows and for them as a reproductive strategy. If you're a male and you're not going to meet many females, when you do, you want to mate and pass your genes on. And so when this occurs, the males are so males mate with a female, and then what better way to ensure that your genes and are going to be passed on by a healthy female than to give her a meal? And that's pretty much what happens here. So people took a harder look at this, and they also realized that females who consume their mates are less apt to mate again, and once again ensuring that male's genetic material gets passed on to the next generation, and that she's also healthier and produces more eggs and more young if she consumes her mate.
Bill Shutt is a biologist, a biology professor at LIU Post on Long Island. He's the author of the book Cannibalism, A Perfectly Natural History. We're getting the ew out of the conversation, getting into the and learning a lot more about why sometimes creatures of the same species eat each other. You can join us on The Exchange at 800-838-3760. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Let's make sure all the kids are out of the room. Yes, it is school time. You can tell us about how Australian redback spiders mate.
Yeah, this is a cousin of the black widow, and so once again, this is the male. The way I guess I described it is that this is kind of like if you can envision having sex with a mate that's the size of a throw pillow, and then you throw in eight legs, and probably don't want to think too much more past that. But after the mating takes place, which is pretty much face to face, the male does this backflip and presents his abdomen. Right before, right in front of the female's mouth, and she reciprocates by starting to consume his abdomen. He crawls off, gets it together for a little while, then it crawls back, mates with her again, and then he is completely consumed, wrapped up in a cocoon, and killed. Once again, another example of the small get eaten.
There's something, I don't know, almost loving about it. It's like he brings a pizza to the date anyway. It's just himself.
Yeah, especially if you're never going to have pizza again.
Exactly. All right, so on to the chapter, Quit Crowding Me. How does captivity change behavior in feeding?
Well, I think the best example there is the horror that some parents and their kids experience when you've got hamsters. Hamsters are a perfect example of a creature that's kept in captivity in conditions that are just about the exact opposite of the natural conditions that a hamster runs into. And so it's a very solitary animal. It only comes out at night. It burrows in sandy ground, and here you are putting it in a habit trail with cats and dogs going by. You're picking this thing up even when it's pregnant, and so you're introducing all of these stressful conditions that drive this creature to abnormal behavior. And this was pretty much the scientific party line for a long time, is that if you saw cannibalism in the animal kingdom, excepting these few examples like the black widow or the praying mantis, that it was going to be caused by either a lack of alternative nutrition or these cramped and crowded conditions associated with captivity. But just taking something and putting it into a tank and leaving it there and not feeding it is, that's just not the way it takes place in the wild. And that was, as I said before, that's how some of the initial observations were made on black widows. It just so happens that they actually do cannibalize, but probably not as often as we would think they do.
All right, so really a different set of conditions in lockup. Chimpanzees, close cousins to us, have they been engaged in cannibalism in lockup?
Yeah, this is a type of cannibalism that is most, you know, sort of reproductive-related cannibalism. And a number of different mammals, including the big cats and chimpanzees, rarely, but they still do it. If a newcomer comes into a group, or in the case of big cats, if a male takes over a pride, and there are females that have young, then the males want to terminate the maternal interest in the maternal care that's taking place, and by doing so, by killing and eating the cubs, or by killing and eating the baby chimp, you're bringing that female into estrus quicker, so that you can incorporate her into your group and pass your genes on to her. So that's probably the most common way that chimpanzees are involved in cannibalism. It is rare; it doesn't happen all the time, but it generally happens when an outsider comes into the group. So they exchange individuals between groups from time to time, and that's when most of those examples have been documented.
Yeah, I remember a fish and wildlife worker telling me this story about black bears occasionally engaging in this behavior.
Absolutely.
Once in a
blue moon. A lot of bears do this. A lot of bears.
Which brings us to the question.
Terminate maternal investment.
Okay, which brings us to the question about polar bears, because there was a big news splash about that. I mean, obviously a lot of attention focused on polar bears as the canary in the coal mine, I guess, when it comes to climate change. So when you took a look at this story more carefully, what did you find out?
Well, first of all, it's far more complex than these splashy, sensationalized media headlines. Polar bears becoming cannibals because of change in environment, you know, the global warming. And this is a really simplified version of what took place, because climate change deniers were really quick to point out that researchers knew that polar bears had been cannibalizing cubs for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. It's just that the media left that part out. Yes, there may be instances now where changes in the amount of ice are causing males to forage in places where they'd never been before, and thus running into females and their cubs. The females try to avoid the males, and now because the males are forced to go to look elsewhere and hunt, they're running into females with their cubs, and so that is probably causing an increase in cannibalism. My bet is that the females are going to adapt to that situation. They're going to move. If you get your cub eaten this year, then next year or the year after, you're not going to go back to that same spot. And so I'm not saying that, you know, that there might not be an increase in cannibalism, but I do believe that this is a far more complex topic than the sensationalized headlines would lead you to believe.
And as you referenced before, a bit more complex when we talk about cannibals in the New World as explorers moved west from Europe. And in fact, the name cannibal, I didn't realize, actually has a connection to the people of the Caribbean.
Yeah, the word cannibal is derived from the Caribs that lived in what we now call the Caribbean.
Wow. So that was another myth to explode there. But you also did look into the Donner Party. I want to make sure we get that mentioned in this conversation. That's a very complicated story as well, isn't it?
Yeah. And this was a real surprise to me, because I figured that we knew everything that there was to know about the Donners. You know, it was when I wrote a book about blood feeding, when I looked at the biology of mosquitoes, I said, well, there's been so much written, so many good books on this. Well, what else could there be? And I didn't really do a lot of work on mosquitoes. And it was really the same thing with the Donners. I was like, oh, you know, what else could there be? This is the most famous example of cannibalism in the history of the United States. And lo and behold, there was a tremendous amount of new information that was coming out when I started to think about writing this book. There were, once again, these splashy, sensationalized headlines. Donner Party may not have had cannibalized their members of their group. And I said, what? And started to ask researchers if this was the truth. And all of them, there was sort of a collective shake of the head where they said, no, absolutely not. Cannibalism took place probably in four different sites. And it was just a mess up by a PR department of a college who released some really, really primary, just some really basic early information that had been gathered by one of their researchers, a faculty member, about one particular campsite and the bones that they found there. And they didn't find any animal bones. They didn't find any human bones. They found heavily processed animal bones, and they wondered, well, there's no humans here. You know, maybe they didn't eat humans. And that just was not the case at all. Animal and human bones were not processed in the same way.
So much in this book, and no time left to talk about it. Definitely worth a look. It's Bill Schutt's book, Cannibalism, A Perfectly Natural History. Bill, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Great to be here. Thank you very much for having me on your show.
Sure. Take care.